Greetings and welcome to the first ever edition, sort of the show Soundography, a crash course in popular music, one artist at a time, taking you through the entire library of their work, as well as the history, the formation of the band, and of course, where are they now? I'm just one of your humble hosts. I'm Brian Ibbett. Welcome. Joining me for this adventure is Mr. Hammond Chamberlain. Welcome, Hammond.
Hey, Brian. Thanks for doing this with me. This is something I've been looking forward to, and I'm glad we're getting it started.
Well, what's fun about this is that, you know, I said this is our first ever episode, which it really is, of Soundography. However, you and I did this once before with an episode of Beyond the Playlist with Kevin Gilbert, talking about the music of Kevin Gilbert.
Yeah, and, we did. And it was a ton of fun doing it. And at the end, I kind of threw out an idea and you fell for it.
You tricked me. It felt like a good... a good project and at least a good experiment just to see how something like this would work. Cause this, again, you know, it's a show that I've always wanted to hear. And that usually is the basis for a podcast that seems to be enjoyable, seems to be entertaining. So we're going to try it out. We're going to see how it goes.
And one of the things that I find really interesting about this concept too is, I mean, there are lots of bands out there who have really great stuff. And sometimes wading through all of their music, mm-hmm. you get tired of it and you don't get to that great stuff. And sometimes those greatest hits albums, they might be the greatest hits according to the charts or the band's right. opinion. But sometimes there are some other things buried deep
right.
that only true fans know about. And those are the things that actually are worth listening to.
The deep cuts, exactly. And fans know about those deep cuts, but maybe the person just getting introduced to the band knows them from, like you said, just from the greatest hits and would never hear those deep cuts otherwise. So,
yeah.
Very cool. Well, our first band that you and I are going to be covering on Soundography is the Alan Parsons Project. It's hard for me not to say that like Dr. Evil. The Alan Parsons Project. Because that is the joke, right?
Yep.
This is interesting because this is a band that I was introduced to by Uncle George. He gets frequently mentioned in my music podcast because he was responsible for, I don't know, 90% of the music that I enjoyed as a kid and kind of have developed into liking as an adult. Stuff like Britpop, Squeeze, Elvis Costello, Nick Lowe, and then kind of evolving. And then also this kind of prog rock side with... bands like King Crimson and Pink Floyd and then the Alan Parsons Project. So let's first talk about the formation, how this started. Is there really an Alan Parsons? He's not like a myth, like
Jethro Tull.
Or Jethro Tull, exactly, or Lynyrd Skynyrd.
No, he actually is a guy. And he was working at Abbey Road Studios in the late 60s and early 70s. And he met Eric Wolfson while he was there. And here's the thing about Parsons is he started his career as an engineer. So as we talk about the album sound and the way they kind of approach music, you have to think about it as they're approaching it as engineering as an art form. Mm-hmm. And he worked on, and like Alan Parsons was an engineer and recording specialist on like the Beatles' Abbey Road album and right. Let It Be. And the thing that I think had the biggest influence on him was he worked on Dark Side of the Moon.
Which is amazing. Yeah, I heard that he actually would switch shifts with people so that he could work the entire time on the project. So on days that or times that he was supposed to be off, he'd actually switch times with people so that he could actually be working on Dark Side of the Moon full time.
Yeah, and it's amazing how you can hear his influence on them and then their influence on him as he continues to move forward. Mm-hmm. And so in 1974, Wolfson and Parsons were talking, and I guess Eric Wolfson had this idea for an Edgar Allan Poe concept album. And they started working on it. And in 1976, we get their first album, their first official album called Tales of Mystery and Imagination. Mm-hmm. And it is a straight up concept album dedicated to the stories and works of Edgar Allan Poe.
And you don't get much more concept albumy than Tales of Mystery and Imagination. I mean, it is from start to finish. It is a tribute and a retelling, and you know, a musical accompaniment to the works of Edgar Allan Poe.
It is, and I it's funny because there are moments of this album that shine, and then other parts of it where they're like, okay, they're kind of forcing the concept,
right. Right.
So I think it was a great place to start for them, and I think it was the beginning of a relationship that really kind of let them experiment in ways they hadn't done so in their regular work.
It seems like you know, when you're working as a producer and working behind the scenes, getting to do that stuff that is producing, you know, getting to be kind of the front of the house kind of stuff on the other side of the studio panel, working in there. However, you know, the vocalists, and you hear a wide range of vocalists all throughout Alan Parsons' project, The Library. You very rarely hear, if ever, Alan Parsons singing. Like, he's doing like backup vocals. Is that right? Is that what I remember?
Yeah, he does a lot of backup stuff. He does a lot of mixing with vocals, but he doesn't actually, I don't think very rarely does he stand out and do it. And interestingly, The Raven was reportedly the first song to ever use a vocoder.
Oh, cool.
And it's one of my favorite pieces of theirs, but yeah, it bleeds into like three other songs in that opening section. And it's hard to separate The Raven from Dream Within a Dream and the beginning of the Orson Welles part that's done within that as well. And then The Raven kicks in, and then you go right into The Telltale Heart, with the really awkward scream at the beginning.
Right. Yeah, that and that's one of those albums that wouldn't work as well in an iTunes age where you just buy one song.
No.
You know, a lot of stuff, really, when you look at it, a lot of the stuff across the library, there's songs that fade into other songs. There's songs that are, you know, their circle is contained within the much larger circle of the songs that precede it or follow it. Sirius and Eye in the Sky, for example, a lot of instrumentals that kind of bleed into other songs that you wouldn't, you know, no one should be going out and buying Sirius on its own without buying Eye in the Sky, or vice versa.
No, exactly. Unless you're a giant Chicago Bulls fan and you just want to have that as your entrance every time you walk into a room.
And that's how people would know that one. We'll
get to that later, but yeah.
Yeah.
So here's the thing about overall for Alan Parsons. As I was doing work, I noticed that they weren't all that popular in the UK, but the United States absolutely loved them. And I'm wondering if it was because of that move in the 80s and the late 70s to album-oriented rock.
Mm-hmm.
Because, I mean, that was in the States, that was the prime time for, prime time, see what I did there?
Oh, well done.
For, you know, concept albums and albums that were cohesive stories and works from beginning to end, and you had to listen to them from beginning to end with your big headphones on in front of the record player, reading the lyrics. So I'm wondering if that was part of it, but they, you know, they then it feels though that they moved to understand the idea of a single, because iRobot move in 1977, a year later, there are singles on iRobot that can be broken off and listened to by themselves.
Yeah, for sure. Let me pull up the track list here. Don't Let It Show, for example. I Wouldn't Want to Be Like You. That actually was a single. That one was released as a single. Such a great song. This actually, you know, I know we're going to talk about favorites later on the show, but I think iRobot is my favorite Alan Parsons album. Just start to finish, it feels like a perfectly cohesive unit. There's favorite songs on there, but there's none on there that I feel like, oh, I've just got to skip over this. It just feels like a good, complete, fun album.
And since we're on the topic, I can say that Eve is almost entirely that album I could skip.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It just, I think they have like Lucifer and maybe Genesis on there. Other than that, I am the two instrumentals. I'm just kind of, it just kind of blends in.
Mm-hmm.
But, But yeah,
it's funny because iRobot almost was going to be pushed later. They wanted to do Wolfson wanted to do a sequel to Tales of Mystery and Imagination, and they changed record labels between Tales of Mystery and Imagination and iRobot, and the new label didn't want to do the sequel to an album that they didn't have the part one of.
And oddly enough, that got pushed back until 2003 after they had separated, and Wolfson did it on his own.
Oh, that is okay. So I saw that in the list. I saw that album. I didn't get a chance to listen to it, but I didn't realize that was the sequel. That was the Tales of Mystery and Imagination Volume 2. Interesting. All right. Yeah,
that's how long it took him to finally get back to it.
Oh.
So.
Interesting.
Turn of the Friendly Card was in 1980. And I think this one stands out as something that was probably the most radio friendly and listener friendly. There was a very pop centered, at times listening or sounding a lot like a cross between Billy Joel and Tangerine Dream.
Mm-hmm.
Very pop, very mid tempo. Nothing's very challenging, but it's all very good.
Right. Games People Play was a hit single from that. Time was released as a single, I believe. And aside from Eye in the Sky, which I would say is probably their biggest hit, I would say Games People Play was probably their closest second single, right? Or was there something that was...
I think it's right. But here's the interesting thing is I think people all know Games People Play, but never no one actually knows it's them.
Right. Yeah, right.
Well, everyone knows the lyrics to it, but they don't realize it's them.
And see, and that's the thing when you've got so many different musicians or so many different vocalists, is that you sound like a different band. The basis of the band may feel the same, but a vocalist really does kind of steer things in different directions with who people recognize as that band. And so on that, Larry Zakatek or Lenny Zakatek was the vocalist on that one.
And the other part of it too is because it was his project to basically experiment with sound and music. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so every album was a different type of experimentation and recording and, you know, how to do vocals and who did the vocals and what your guitar tone sounded like. So they never were able to kind of lock down they did lock down a sound, which we'll get to in a second, but it still, every album is unique enough that unless you are really paying attention, you could just be, oh yeah, it's just another one of those, just another pop song.
Mm-hmm.
But here's the thing about Alan Parsons is that he does have very signature sounds. He has very signature progressions. And when he works on something, he definitely leaves his fingerprints all over it.
Yeah.
So I think a great example of that is Lady Hawk, which many people might deride as one of the most inappropriate soundtracks to a period piece ever.
Because it's all modern sounding in this period, in this, you know, magic and monsters kind of world.
Yes, but it was an Oscar nominated piece.
Oh, I didn't realize that. Really?
Yeah. And wow. It was because of the recording. And so it gives Alan Parsons credit for that. But here's the thing. If you listen to Mamma Gamma and The Silence and I, which is on, Mamma Gamma's on, I can't remember which one it's on, but Silence and I is on Eye in the Sky.
Yeah, and Mamma Gamma's on that as well.
There are huge swaths of those pieces of music that sound like they were lifted directly from Lady Hawk. Yeah, so Andrew Powell.
Oh, there you go. Right. Orchestra arranged and conducted by Andrew Powell.
Yes. So his, whatever Alan Parsons and Andrew, whatever their relationship was, they were sharing a lot of ideas back and forth because Mamma Gamma and The Silence and I could be exchanged at certain parts of the Lady Hawk soundtrack. Now, I'm not saying I like the Lady Hawk soundtrack. I'm just not sure I like it with that movie, if that makes any sense.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
I can listen to it on its own.
For a different movie, you think it would be more appropriate or more, there would be more of a connection.
Yeah. I mean, and it's great. I mean, I love the way it sounds. It feels very kind of modern swashbuckly, but I just don't see it, you know, Rutger Hauer riding around a giant black horse holding a sword, talking to his hawk, is a weird thing when you hear this weird synthy, gallopy, definitely synthesized horns kind of thing.
Yeah.
So I don't know. It's interesting how they all kind of lead together.
Interesting. And that one, and that album, the whole Eye in the Sky album, another one that was, again, very radio friendly, had probably their biggest hit. And then the other song that people know but don't necessarily associate with Alan Parsons, which is that instrumental beginning to Eye in the Sky, which is called Sirius. There's quite a few examples of that, by the way, in great classic rock, like what's the Boston one that leads into, there's an instrumental song that leads into
Launch, something like that.
Something like that, right. It leads into Don't Look Back, if I remember correctly, or anyway, there's great examples of
that. There are. No, there are
great examples of that I just can't come up with right now. But some more great vocals, and this time by Eric Wolfson, doing Eye in the Sky. He's kind of, I don't know if there's really a regular vocalist. I mean, Lenny Zakatek does a lot of songs. Just looking through the list here of other ones, you don't see a lot of them come up over and over, except for Eric Wolfson, Lenny Zakatek. But if for a band that is named after the producer,
yes, exactly.
You'd think that Eric Wolfson would have said, "Hey, dude, can we call this the Alan Parsons Eric Wolfson project? Come on, I'm doing vocals for this thing."
And a lot of the writing, because he was as much of a writer. And it's funny when they later in their careers, when they split ways, you can definitely see who brought what to the table. Because as you listen to their solo works, Alan Parsons definitely takes on his sound, and you can pull out what he brought to the Alan Parsons project. And then you can listen to the Wolfson's work and know exactly what he brought to the Alan Parsons project as well. So
interesting.
Yeah. It's very interesting how their solo work actually reveals as much about their work together as anything else. One thing I can say about, I think it was Eye in the Sky. It had the Total Eclipse on there. That was a really, really hard listen, and it was long.
Let's see here. No, not on that one. Hold on. I'm looking through.
No, Silence in the Eye was in Divine in the Sky.
Right. Silence in the Eye. Yep. Turn of a Friendly Card, maybe? No.
All I did was I wrote down in my notes, Eclipse was a hard listen.
Let's see. Oh, Total Eclipse. It's the ninth track on iRobot. Oh. The album that I like.
Yes. It's very atonal. It was really long. It was very experimental sounding. It was very hard to listen to.
Interesting. Yeah, I can see that. I mean, because it is kind of the bookend instrumental piece, I guess it's not. There are some vocals, some choir style vocals in there. And then they close out with the instrumental Genesis chapter 1, verse 32, which is interesting. Yeah, it's, I don't know, for some reason that song didn't disconnect with me like it did for you.
It pulled me right out of it, enough so that I actually made a point of bringing it up. So the one thing I can say is the 80s sexy sax comes up a lot throughout the first few albums. And it's very, if you've listened to any music produced in the 80s or seen any movies in the 80s, you know exactly which saxophone I'm talking about.
Yeah.
That definitely shows up. Ammonia Avenue, Vulture Culture, they kind of, I don't know, they nothing stood out a ton to me about them.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, I liked Ammonia Avenue. I liked Don't Answer Me. And again, another one that was released as a single, and actually the only Alan Parsons Project music video I ever remember seeing was for Don't Answer Me, which I think is just a beautiful, beautifully written and beautifully sung songs. As a matter of fact, looking through my songs later on in the show, we each picked our favorite five songs. I almost wish I would have included that one because I really, really love that song.
Well, it's funny. Eye in the Sky, I remember the video for, because it was like a Pulp Fiction, or not a Pulp Fiction, Pulp cartoon.
Yes, right. It was like three-dimensional cutouts of comic books kind of thing that you were layered and but it was very pulpy. It was very 1950s style. The guy has the girl. He loses the girl to the villain. He goes and fights the villain, gets the girl back, kind of thing.
Yes. And the interesting thing about Eye in the Sky, it is the most famous, probably one of the most famous mid-tempo rock songs ever written.
Sure.
Is led into by one of the most tension-building instrumentals ever written.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that that ever-increasing crescendo cracks on the rocks of mid-tempo rock has always been a weird transition for me, because it builds and builds and builds and builds and then goes right into this, like, into this weird mid-tempo feeling.
Right, this like a slow pop song.
Yeah, you want a big guitar chord and then some screaming vocals, maybe even like a Boston song.
Right.
But
no, that's a really good point.
It leads into this mid-tempo classic.
Right.
The couple skating classic.
Wow, that's funny. Yeah, totally true. And I'm trying to see here. I remember reading that, and I'm trying to figure out who the vocalist is, kind of the connection. But so one of the bands that Alan Parsons worked with, aside from the Beatles and Pink Floyd, was the band Ambrosia, 70s. 70s mid-tempo pop stalwarts.
Yeah.
Ambrosia. But they, let's see, all of the members played on Tales of Mystery and Imagination. And I'm trying to see, there we go, here it is. The David Pack was the vocalist for Ambrosia. And he appeared on, I guess it wasn't until Try Anything Once. For some reason, I was thinking that he might have done vocals earlier.
I can tell you, skipping over a couple of them, Try Anything Once is a really, really good album. That was actually my rediscovery of Alan Parsons in the mid-90s.
Really?
Yeah. I saw that in the store, and it kind of struck a chord just because it was Alan Parsons. It was something that kind of made me feel like, oh, yeah, I liked them when I was little.
Mm-hmm.
I bought it.
And this is a solo. This was like,
mm-hmm. Yeah. And I bought it, and I really have to admit, it kind of rekindled this love of Alan Parsons and started going back and listening to other things.
Interesting. I'll have to listen to that one. I didn't pick up any of the solo stuff, but would you say that out of all of the solo works by Alan Parsons, would that be the one to...
That would be the one to start with, very much so. Okay. Yeah. Try Anything Once. I actually picked... one of my number one song that I picked on the list is actually from that album.
Oh, really? Mm-hmm. Okay, cool. So maybe you're listening to David Pack from Ambrosia doing the vocals for that track.
They also have a killer song on there too called Mr. Time that has a female vocalist, and it's just awesome.
Wow, see, that's something you never, I don't remember ever hearing in an Alan Parsons Project song is a female vocalist.
Yeah, she's awesome. I can't think of her name off the top of my head, but it was great. Yeah. Here's the interesting thing is they switched record labels again, and Alan Parsons kind of was upset about it. So they wrote this album called The Sicilian Defense, and when they presented it to the record company, they rejected it. And he sat on it then for 30 years until it was finally released as a bonus disc in this box set. Just recently, like last year.
Oh, really? Okay.
And
yeah, 2014, it says. Wow.
I listened to it on a streaming service, and I can see why the record label kind of didn't want it, because it's very, very different. And you could tell he kind of wrote it as it felt like it was written as a spite piece. I can see though why people would want to hear it though, because it's definitely part of the evolution and the growth of them as a band.
Interesting. I'll have to listen to that. It's I'm guessing like Spotify or something like that probably has it. Okay, yeah. Cool. Yeah, and I guess that's the risk you run when you're crafting the music that you want to craft that may not necessarily be radio friendly or, you know, pop based, is that the record labels are going to be, you know, kind of pushed back unless you've got an established career record. And they must not have had it completely built up enough by then to be able to say, okay, this is the album we want to do for us.
Yeah, I think that in those early days, like in the late 80s and mid 80s, the record label still had all the power. Mm-hmm. I don't think the artist had much control at all. And the fact that he was able to do even some of the stuff he wanted to do was out of respect that they had for him.
Sure.
But they still had final say. Hmm. So, and then we get to like Stereotomy, which I love. Stereotomy 1 and 2, the bookends, the kind of... The first part of the song and the second part, I love those.
Oh, gotcha, okay.
But the rest of the album, again, kind of just falls into almost background music.
Yeah, I'm looking through the song list here, and this was one of the ones I picked up as part of the smaller box set, and none of those songs are jumping out to me as ones that I kind of earmarked as, oh yeah, that's one I want to listen to it again.
Beaujolais is on there, I think, and that's a pretty good song. It sounds very much like The Police, to be honest with you. It's a good song, but Stereotomy is definitely my favorite on that album.
So, and it's another, and it harkens back yet again to Edgar Allan Poe, as a word, stereotomy came from the murders in the Rue Morgue.
Oh yeah, that's right.
So they do tend to dip into that well, certainly the well of literature, right? Because Isaac Asimov had wrote I, Robot, Edgar Allan Poe, of course, referenced Now I Know in a couple different albums. So
I think Ammonia Avenue and Vulture Culture both might be literary references, but I'm not.
Oh, really?
I'm not smart enough to know them.
Culture Vulture was used to describe a person well-versed in the arts. Eric Wolfson flipped it around, described these activities as part of a vulture culture, and this concept of man's inhumanity to man was the underlying theme of the album.
Huh.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Excellent. Well, let's see here. Anything else on the... So we talked about Parsons' solo stuff, or dipped into it.
Well, we dipped into it a little bit. I did want to bring up that Gaudy was kind of a musical that Wolfson wanted to do. And it ended up being kind of the end of the end of the Alan Parsons project. And then in 1990, they regrouped, and they just did it as Alan Parsons and Eric Wolfson. They did Freudania. Mm-hmm. And 1990. And it's another kind of musical, which is really a concept album. So they kind of, in a weird way, went full circle back to the concept album.
Interesting.
But they did it as a musical because Wolfson kind of, I think from the sounds of it, Wolfson wanted to be a musical guy. I think he wanted to do things for the stage. Because mm-hmm. when he moved on his solo stuff in 95, he actually released Gaudy the Musical. In 95. So he kind of didn't let those things. Then also in 09, he actually released the Poe the Musical. And then in 2013, he released an album called Somewhere in the Audience. So okay. I feel like Wolfson kind of wanted to do musical stuff.
Right. Very interesting. And it makes sense, too, because when you look at concept albums, they share a lot of DNA with musicals. The underlying theme that connects everything, each song helps to kind of propel the story forward. So you know, it seems like a natural progression to go from doing concept albums into doing writing for musicals. And then Gotti based on, or at least a tribute to, is that right?
Yeah.
An architect, Antonio Gotti.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
Very interesting.
So it seems as if when they were writing their stories or pulling information for their albums, they were always looking at very cerebral, kind of heady things anyway.
Right. Very academic.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yep.
It's almost like you could listen to their albums and get like the cliff notes to
yeah, exactly.
to Spanish architecture or old literature.
and early psychology.
Early psychology, science fiction, sure. Right.
I will bring up his solo work because I leaned on a little bit with my list. Mm-hmm. Try Anything Once came out in 93, which if you're going to start with his solo work, start there.
Okay.
On Air is a fantastic album. I actually have it 5.1. It was one of the first ones I got. And it's an amazing, because he's an engineer. Imagine what he can do with 5.1 at his fingertips.
No kidding.
Time Machine, Valid Path, they're okay. They have a couple of good songs on them, but it seems like he was releasing them to release them. It doesn't seem like there was anything that really stands out.
Okay.
Then Wilson's solo career, he actually released an album on his own called San Toque in 71 before he got in touch with Alan Parsons.
Right, that would have been before Tales of Mystery, like 5 years before Tales of Mystery and Imagination. Oh, interesting.
And then he did various versions of Freudnania in 1991, different musical versions and different recordings of it. Then Gotti the Musical in 95, he did something on The Gambler in 97. More Tales of Mystery and Imagination in 03.
There it is, yeah.
Dancing Shadows in 07. The Alan Parsons Project That Never Was in 09.
And that's actually the title of the album, The Alan Parsons Project That Never Was?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Then he released Edgar Allan Poe the Musical in 09 again. And then Somewhere in the Audience in 2013.
Hmm. And is he taking the role, obviously, writer, because that was what he was doing a lot for APP. But was he also taking vocal duties, or is he kind of continuing that method of bringing other vocalists in?
When he was working with the musical stuff, he was doing a lot of that with other people. But mm-hmm. I'm not as familiar with his solo stuff as I probably should be.
Okay.
So, but yeah, it's something I want to dig further into because I'm kind of intrigued. Sure. So
there's so much of a library here with all these, the albums together, the solo albums, soundtrack work. It's a lot to take in. So it seems like that's a good way to kind of segue into the 10 songs.
Yep.
I'm not skipping over anything. Are
no, I? No. Okay. I was going to bring up those last two things at the end.
Okay. Cool. So this is the kind of purpose of the 10 songs is to give each of us a chance to pick 5 songs that listening through their library that we connected with really well and almost serve as if you're going to start somewhere, start with these 10 songs. Look them up on Spotify, on iTunes, Amazon. In some cases, you're not going to want to just go and buy. You're not going to want to go spend the 99 cents and just buy that song because it may, like we said earlier in the show, segue into something else. But why don't I go first? Because I think mine are, between the two of us, I think mine are probably more surface level stuff while you've got kind of the deeper cuts.
Okay.
I think. First on my list is Old and Wise, which is a song from the Eye in the Sky album. I'm pulling it up right here. It's the closing track, and again, it's got that, I think, the Eric Wolfson vocals on it. Just such a cool... Oh, no, I take that back. It's Colin Blunstone is the vocalist. Eric Wolfson's doing piano and organ work on it. But it's such a beautiful song, and when you listen to the lyrics, they're very melancholy, wistful, but not in a depressing way. Is it weird to say that it's a melancholy song that's not depressing?
No, I kind of think of it as a, it's like listening to a memory.
Right, right. Or eulogy even.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Beautiful track though. Closing track on the Eye in the Sky album. Next one in my list is the opening track to the album of the same name, I, Robot, an instrumental track. They did a lot of this where they'd open the album with an instrumental song and then go into a vocal track. Into their mid-tempo rocker. In this case, it was I, Robot kind of leading into I Wouldn't Want to Be Like You.
Mm-hmm.
But that, as good as Sirius is and as good as some of their other instrumentals are, I, Robot, I think, is my favorite of their instrumentals. It's got that same kind of slow build-up. But you can imagine this in the background of a soundtrack to a movie, like having the background of something going on, like a montage, a building montage, various things like that. I think it's a really, it's a really cool song.
You know, it's interesting, that you bring up that they do this. So the Blue Man Group has released two albums. And their first tracks are in a lot of instrumentals. Their first album was nothing but instrumentals. Second one has a vocalist. But their first track is usually relatively short, and they do it to establish the sound of the album. So you get to hear pretty much all the instruments that are going to be used on that album.
Oh, cool.
In that first little piece. So you kind of know what to expect going in.
And it's like... It's like the opening credits or even a foreword. Yeah, the overture. Sure. Right.
And I'm wondering if Alan Parsons, with their musical thoughts and their concept album thoughts, were doing the same kind of things where you had a taste of it before you got in and you got to hear kind of what to expect throughout the album.
Sure. That makes sense. That totally makes sense.
I'm just speculating.
Coming from their background, that seems like it would be logical,
yeah.
Right? Because there's lots of classical music influences that you hear throughout all their stuff. So totally makes sense. The next track, actually the next two that I mentioned, come from the 1978 album Pyramid, Pyromania, which is a song. Here's the thing. When I was a kid, I loved this song, and I felt like it was just somebody's unholy obsession with pyramids. Which I haven't looked at the lyrics since then. I listened to the song, of course, but I'm just going to say that's exactly what it's about. Like almost a tinfoil hat kind of personality that is obsessed with pyramids everywhere. Say that until somebody proves me wrong. The other track, again from the same album, is What Goes Up, which is a very, you know, we talk about their academia. This is kind of like a philosophical set of questions. If all things must fall, why build a miracle at all? If all things must pass, even a pyramid won't last. You know, what goes up must come down. It's a very, I don't know, it's a very cool song. It almost doesn't. Lyrically, it fits on Pyramid, but I feel like it could have been placed on any of their albums,
yeah.
Musically. And then the last one in my set is from that very first album. It's The Raven, which we talked about, the first use of vocoder. And vocals, from what I've been able to tell, actually one of the few vocal performances you hear from Alan Parsons himself. It's him with the vocoder. And it is a, it's an electronic reading, electronic vocoder reading of the Raven from start to finish. But it's got a really cool kind of a two-dimensional arrangement feel to it. I really love it.
Between the vocoder and the surprise vocals, it really does stand out because it gets you.
And it was hard for me to choose, you know, because I wanted to pick something from that first album, and I was trying to decide between Dr. Tarr and Professor Feather, which is just a fun song, but The Raven, I think I like a little bit more. And it's a good... You know, it's again, it follows their opening instrumental, the Orson Welles bit, and then goes right into The Raven. I think The Raven's a really, really good track.
So the version of the album that I have is the 2007 remastered with bonus stuff.
Okay.
Uh-huh. There's a demo of The Raven on there. And I have to tell you, I'm really glad they made the changes to it that they did.
Really?
Because it's a little bit Brady Bunch soundy. Let's do The Raven.
Really?
It's a little bit fast, and it's a little bit up-tempo, and I'm glad they slowed it down and then added the vocoder and all these other elements to it, because as it stood as a demo, it was I don't want to say laughable, but it was a little bit silly.
Really? Oh, yeah. I'm totally going to have to find that, listen to it. Yeah. That sounds hilarious.
Yeah. That whole album's got a lot of demos on it, the one that I have, and hearing the evolution from demo to song is always interesting, but with them it's even more so because you also know not only they work on it as musicians, but they also worked on it as engineers.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, they can look at it from both sides of the glass, basically.
Yeah.
I guess it's two things on the same side of the glass, but on different sides of the mixing board. Let's
say exactly.
That.
Yeah.
Very cool.
All right. So for mine, my first one is from Try Anything Once, and it's Wine from Water. You can wind me down. There's no escape, but I'll never drown. No wires or strings, no rough and smooth. Just fire and basically, it's a story about a magician. And how he fools people. And when you extrapolate that out further, you can make it about politicians, you can make it about all kinds of things and make it fit however you want to interpret it. But the basic of it is a magician. And the reason I like this is it starts out with a very slim instrumental. And then as the song builds, it gets thicker and thicker and more to it. So there's that evolution within the song that really stands out, and I like it. My next one is Primetime from Ammonia Avenue. Maybe for the only time in my life, something in the air. Turning me around and guiding me right. And it's a prime time, maybe the stars were right. And the reason I like that is it just... It's got interesting structure to it and makes me want to listen. The way that the chorus kicks in, the way that the verses work, there's something that makes me interested and want to listen and figure out what it's trying to tell me. It's one of those ones that when you're listening to in a mix or whatever, because I have it on my phone just as a single, and when it comes on, I stop because it grabs me. And that's something that I noticed throughout listening to all of the catalog, is that every now and then the song reaches up out of the arguable sameness and grabs you and makes you pay attention to it. And then you can kind of go back into listening to and enjoying just the sound of the Alan Parsons Project. But this is one of those ones that just totally grabs you.
Cool.
My next one is The Famous Games People Play. I love this because in my head, I'd love to see this done by a choir with different soloists. And then when they reach the choruses, it's done by the full choir with a big band behind it, big rockin' band behind it, a la Crescent Super Band.
Okay, yep.
Something along that with some really snappy vocals with it.
That would be cool.
That's something that I would like to hear. That's just my own dream. But but other than that, I love this song. I make a joke that I feel like it's about a retirement home.
I remember you mentioning that. Listening to the lyrics after hearing you say that, it totally fits. It totally makes sense, which is really funny.
Yeah. So I don't know if it is or not, but that's the way I look at it. So my next one is actually from another one of his solo albums called On Air, and it's Fall Free. Baseline. The whole album is about flight, different, space flight, all kinds of different levels of flight. In fact, the album starts and ends with, jet noises and bird noises, and then it takes you through basically the air. And this Fall Free is about free fall. And it has that, the heart pounding anticipation for it, but also has this very airy chorus that goes with it, so it fits the concept. And it's just, I may be biased to it because I listened to it in 5.1 and you can feel it. And I really do love that song.
Cool.
So my last one, I'll be honest, when I talked to you first, Brian, I said Fall of the House of Usher kind of bothered me. Mm-hmm. When I listened to it this time, I put headphones on, I laid in the middle of my living room floor with the lights out, and just listened to it because I wanted to understand if I really didn't like it or if it was just something else. And right. I'll be honest with you, it totally took me on a journey. It is a soundtrack for your imagination. From Orson Welles and the sound effects that are kind of buried in there and just the way the music works, it takes you on a journey. It is their first foray into soundtrack land. Mm-hmm. And it's a little rough at times, but I have to say, I came out of that experiment feeling as if it's one of the strongest pieces in their catalog.
Interesting. And this is like a 5-track
epic.
Epic, right, in the middle of Tales of Mystery and Imagination.
Uh-huh.
Prelude, Arrival, Intermezzo, Pavane, and Fall.
Yeah, it's pretty much the entire second side of the, if you're going to look at it as an album or a cassette, it's almost all a side B. Mm-hmm. Then they had this weird song kind of shoehorned at the end of the track, which I feel like doesn't fit. But
To One in Paradise,
yeah. It's a strange album song to end an album on, especially after something like Fall of the House of Usher. Mm-hmm. So those are mine. I feel like I think we did a good job of splitting their catalog between their, like you said, the poppy kind of accessible side.
Right.
And the more proggy, deeper side.
And really, it doesn't surprise me, knowing the kinds of music you and I both like. We did really kind of stick to the not knowing some of these solo tracks you picked, but we did kind of stick to the, you know, what our hearts are in.
Yeah, where, right? Our wheelhouses
the
pop, are.
The prog, so it's perfect. Very cool. Well, that's a good way to discover the band, those 10 songs. And obviously you heard the clips, the audio clips running underneath our narration, but we encourage you to go out and pick up any of the stuff you enjoyed. More so than any other group, I'd say if you enjoyed one or two of the clips you hear from an album, pick up the whole album, because again, it's one of those things that needs to be listened to as a full piece and not necessarily as individual tracks in an iTunes age.
Yeah, it's hard, because even now I have a lot of their stuff on my phone now over the last couple of weeks, and it comes up in rotation and
shuffle.
Yeah, in shuffle. And I have to tell you, it's odd to go from, you know, Everything at Once by that female artist, that British female artist. It's weird going and then hearing some of these out of context. We mentioned this with Alan Earth, Kevin Gilbert, that sometimes it needs the context to make it work.
Yes,
and
right.
With Alan Parsons, I think more than maybe almost anybody else on our list of bands, context is almost as important as anything else with these songs.
Sure. No, totally makes sense. And probably just as disconcerting if you hear Sirius and it doesn't lead into Eye in the Sky.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. If it goes from Sirius to like a Mushroomhead tune, it really does mess with your brain.
Right. Very good. Well, excellent. So there is your deep dive into the Alan Parsons Project, your crash course in popular music, one artist at a time. We won't give you a quiz. No pop quiz here at the end. We'll just trust that you learned something about Alan Parsons. And if you want to get in touch with us, we'll have some audio or some information on the website over there at soundography.com. That's still in the process of getting put together as of the recording of this show. But way more to come from the two of us and Soundography. So on behalf of Hammond Chamberlain and me, this is Brian Ibbett saying thank you for joining us. We will see you next time on Soundography.